Welcome to the Everything EC podcast. I am your host, Carla Ward, and today we're going to talk literacy with Stacey Binge, keynote speaker and author of The Whole Child Alphabet. Stacey has a master's of science degree in human development and family studies and has spent over a decade in the early childhood classroom teaching children from birth to five. Welcome to the show, Stacey. I am so excited to have you here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into your book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm Stacey Binge. I'm an early childhood speaker and presenter. I've been in the early childhood field for almost 30 years now. Started out like working in the classroom with children birth to five and did that on and off, kind of depending on if I was in school or not, and then where I was as a parent, but did that up until like about 2007, 2008. And then at that point, I kind of stepped more into the realm of professional development and speaking. And then I am now the author of The Whole Child Alphabet. Over COVID, we became empty nesters. Both of our boys went off to college, and I always kind of had this book in my mind, and my husband's like, you know, this is the time to do it. It's COVID. We have no children at home. Go for it. So yeah.
That is so awesome. And I have to give props to your husband. I was telling you before we logged on, I was watching your unboxing video, and I just think that your husband is just the sweetest. He is so proud of you. And I love that. You can tell that he is just like the proudest husband on the face of the earth.
He is. I mean, and he's like my biggest fan, my biggest encourager. And in fact, in the book, I dedicate to my parents and my boys, but like, I'm like, he's the one who believes in me and the one who nudges me when I need it and then cheers me on when I need it. But he's awesome.
That's awesome. And I mean, I always say like ECE partners, they didn't know what they were signing up for, but they certainly are our number one cheerleaders because we couldn't do it without them holding down the fort sometimes when we're writing books, exhausted, laminating, whatever it is that we do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I once had my husband make hundreds of bags of reindeer food for my class. And he's like, what is this again? And I'm like, it's reindeer food. And he's like, but it's glitter. So yeah, they never
exactly
know what they're going to sign up.
That's what it is.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I am just so excited to be talking about your book. Literacy is something that I am so passionate about. And I have a tutoring company and I've seen that, you know, flashcards don't work. Flashcards are not they're not result driven. They're memory driven. They get great results from memory. But I'm just so excited to talk about the whole child. So first things first, yes, you were in COVID, but what provoked you to even start developing this idea?
So really the book is really based on several of my trainings, and the trainings were based on, I used to go in and do observation in classrooms for people getting their CDA credential, the Child Development Associates credential. And I would notice when I would go in the classroom, just a lot of emphasis on letter of the week. And when I was in the classroom, that's what we did too. And I never felt like I got the results I wanted, I guess you would say, or didn't feel like the children really were latching onto it. And then when I was observing classrooms, I was kind of seeing the same thing. So I'd start having conversations, you know, with the teachers afterwards, you know, after the observation, and just say, okay, let's talk about this letter of the week. Let's talk about the overemphasis you have on the alphabet. And, you know, I would bring up, there's so much more to literacy than just the alphabet. The alphabet is necessary, but it's not sufficient on its own. So, you know, I'd bring up all the other things we could be doing, and I'd bring up why letter of the week wasn't ideal. And what the teachers a lot of times would say to me is, totally agree with what you're saying, but what do we do instead? Like, what is that other thing we should be doing? So I created a training called Do This, Not That Alphabet Knowledge. This was like 7-8 years ago. And that training evolved over the years. And I even put a new title on it. But after like, I don't know how many people came up to me and they're like, you should write a book on this. You should write a book on it. Because I think what I was bringing to the table was not only looking at what else has to exist for literacy, but what needs to develop before children can even approach the alphabet. You know, let's get even deeper. Let's start looking at you know, the first 3 years, what all has to be developed. And so really that's how that all kind of blossomed and how the book kind of came together.
Oh my gosh, I so needed you when I was in the classroom because you've nailed it on the head. Was when I was moving into play-based learning, I knew that letter of the week was not following the philosophy of play. I knew that. Mm-hmm. But I had 14 parents that wanted to know how I was teaching the alphabet. So it was like this balance of, okay, I'm satisfying this. I know mm-hmm. that it's not hitting the target. So I'm supplementing with play, but I kind of felt like I was kind of in limbo a little bit without a direction because there wasn't an answer to that question of what do I do instead?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's what I tried to kind of fill in some of those gaps and just really look at what should we be doing instead, and then try to also embrace that we don't have to have just a literacy activity for what we're doing to really support literacy. And then really trying to bridge that gap between how does play, child-led play at that, really support all of this.
Oh my gosh, just that is so awesome. So I want to dive into the chapters of your books because I feel like it's almost, without it being a curriculum, I feel like it's a perfect roadmap from how to get from start to finish in your planning as an educator and how we can essentially teach the whole child alphabet.
Yes. Yeah.
Perfect. So walk us through your chapters.
Well, I kind of start off with like the, you know, just looking at the fundamentals of literacy and kind of trying to get a little bit deep with that. And then I start going into, for children to learn the alphabet, they've got to have an interest and connection. And so that's the chapter I kind of look at. You know, we have to look at children as individuals, not just a, you know, check mark on a curriculum, but like what's important to them, what's important in their lives, because really and truly their children are like adults. We want to learn things that are important to us that we have an interest in. Well, it's the same thing with young children. So if we're introducing letters, just standardized checkoff lists, and the letters do not connect to the child's world, they're not going to connect that letter. So we have to look at children as individual, what's important to them, and what is it that they're actually interested in. And then I kind of start breaking down what are some of the other, you know, foundations needed, not only for alphabet knowledge, but for literacy. So visual processing, visual perception, you know, I look at that, you know, that's not just eyesight, but that is the brain really understanding and interpreting what's coming in from the eye. So the visual closure, visual constancy, figure ground, which is like being able to pull, you know, letters from the background or really any object, but I tried to connect it to literacy. Then I looked at phonological awareness. You know, part of alphabet knowledge is recognizing that every letter has a distinct sound. Well, before we can connect to those sounds, we have to develop phonological awareness, or specifically phonemic awareness. So, you know, what does that look like? And then how does play address that? And then I looked at physical development, which I'm super, super passionate. I'm passionate about all of it, but physical development is one that I just get like so excited about, because children writing the letters, it doesn't start with us just putting a pencil in their hand. Their bodies have to develop. And it's not just fine motor skills, which is very important. It is the whole body, like the neck and the torso and the shoulders, and then our internal senses. It's all that supporting the hand. So I kind of dive into that in the book. And then I look at how play really is the catalyst for all that.
Amen to that.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, if children are playing, how does it support that? Like how, and what I tried to do is to give teachers and even if parents are reading it too, but like really just the tools and the vocabulary to say, okay, this is what's happening. And this is why play is essential for all of this developing. So that's pretty much it, I would say, you know, in a nutshell. I think I hit almost all the chapters on that.
That's awesome. You did. I have a whole list on my side. And honestly, I love it. And I want to circle back to vision, because vision therapy is something that I have really become interested in. And I work alongside a vision therapist, asking him questions all the time, because I'm finding that I've had so many students diagnosed with certain learning disabilities, and sometimes it is the actual learning disability that they've been diagnosed with. But I've had so many students who have gone to a developmental optometrist, and it's actually the vision and that hand-eye coordination that is suffering, and they can't make the connection. So they're looking at a page and they're so overwhelmed because their eyes and brain are not working together. Mm-hmm. And I just find it so fascinating. And that vision really starts in the early years.
Oh, yes. And I think that's, and when I started learning about it, it was more so as a parent. And I kind of talk about this in the book. My oldest son, who's almost 25, he has given me full permission to share some of these stories. But it started with him, like in the first grade, constantly putting his head on the desk. And I was working with that first grade teacher. And as we were kind of tapping into some details of some struggles he was having, I finally took him to a developmental optometrist who diagnosed him with convergence insufficiency, which is where, you know, your eyes don't go in to see close-up work. And so when he was reading on a page, instead of his eyes converging and seeing one image, he was seeing double images, or the words were jumping around. So he started covering his eye or putting his head down. And that's when I first started learning about visual perception and just really the brain and the eyes working as a team. And then several years later, when I took him to an occupational therapist, is where I started learning more and more. And, you know, it really is something that I think we are seeing more children struggle with. You know, is it, do we know more about it? Or, you know, I don't have the research to back it up, but I'm kind of like, kids are not playing as much and they're not in a 3D world as much where they're using their eyes and their hands together. And, you know, I can't help but think that that might be connected.
Oh, I would 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
Oh, I would say yes. We may not have the research, but I'm sure it's out there.
Yeah. Or somebody needs to start looking into it now.
Yeah. Well, and even tracking. And like, so what my developmental optometrist has is he has these glasses that you put on and it tracks how the child or adult is reading. And are they reading from left to right in one order, or are their eyes bouncing, or is one eye bouncing while the other is trying to track? And it just blows my mind. And your son was diagnosed early, but I've had students diagnosed as late as grade 10, grade 11. And wow. My one student, he was about to have his third eye surgery. And I was like, hold on, before we have his eye surgery, I said, why don't you go see my guy? And mm-hmm. he did. And the optometrist had concluded, he said, your son is living in double vision.
Wow.
And as he did vision therapy, all of his behaviors reduced, his reluctance to go to school reduced. Like, this was a child who had been diagnosed with a learning disability and ADHD. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying he doesn't have those things, but all of a sudden we were seeing him sitting for longer periods of time because he could participate. He could see what was happening on the board. He could translate. And it was incredible. And in a two-dimensional world of iPads, mm-hmm. they're just not getting the far away and close up practice that children get when they build, when they play, when they throw things. Mm-hmm. And it's just, oh, I love talking about that. So I absolutely fell in love when I was like, oh my gosh, you've written a whole chapter on it.
I feel like it's something that we haven't quite tapped into yet, you know, and I have been getting a lot of feedback about that chapter specifically, because it's kind of like, oh, wow, well, you know, why are we not maybe focusing on this a little bit more? And to me, I'm just saying, hey, this is just a little bit more reason as to why children, we should have them playing and just, you know, why that is so important and part of this developmental process.
100%. And we think hand-eye coordination. And we know that hand-eye coordination means that your hands are working with your eyes to do something. But I think we almost have to go beyond the basic hand-eye coordination and go deeper. Well, what does that mean? What does that look like? It's not just that their fingers have the ability, it's that their brain, eyes, and hands are working together.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's something that has to develop, and we have to give children the opportunity and the space and the environment to develop it. It's not something that just is there. And so again, if children are not playing and they're not using their brain and their eyes and their hands together, it's not going to develop.
Exactly. And to your point earlier, it's not going to mean anything when they go to learn those letters.
Exactly. Right. Right. Yeah.
Back in the day, most of my students knew the letter F, not because I taught it to them, but it's because Frozen was the number one movie and they could recognize the letter F anywhere because
exactly.
it meant something to them.
Uh-huh. It has to connect to their worlds. And you know, a story I share in that chapter is my youngest son was, you know, to him, he had no interest in learning the alphabet. And I remember him even saying, like, when he was 4 years old, like, I don't care. I don't want to do this right now. And you know, they've got to have an interest and a motivation. And his motivation when he finally learned the letters was he had a pretty big crush on his kindergarten teacher. And he wanted to, like, you know, really impress her. And how do you impress her? Show her that you know all the letters. And that was like, that was his motivation. And so it's like, what connects to their world? What's important to them? And we have to start there and go from there. You know, everything else is just kind of spinning the wheel, honestly.
Absolutely. But then on the other end, and I don't like being a yes, but I'm going to be for a second, is you have a class of kindergartners or preschoolers, and they have all different interests. How do you make sure that you are supporting that alphabet development and the child?
You know, and I think that's where play comes back in. And that if we have an environment that's designed for child-led play, that I think it's way easier to put materials and, you know, things of their interest when it's an open-ended play environment. And then that way, if children are playing, it's something they're interested in and their friend comes to play with them, then they kind of open up each other's worlds. But to me, when you kind of have it that way and it's child-led, it like really creates all these organic opportunities. You know, if they're building a block structure of something that's important to them and we have blank paper and crayons there and they want to draw something, maybe they want to add to the block structure like some sort of design or whatever on it. And they might bring that paper to us and go, how do you spell this? Well, that's a word that's important to them. And so that's our opportunity that we go, oh, you know, how do you spell spaceship? And then you spell it out for them to see it. And they tend to connect to that. And so I think if we kind of open that environment up and let them lead it and them kind of tell us, they really grasp it a lot quicker because it's important to them.
That's so true. I did a presentation last night and I was telling the people that attended that my kindergartners 1 year could all spell the word Burj Khalifa. It was the funniest thing because we had studied buildings and all of their buildings, because it was the tallest and kindergartners are competitive and it was the winner. One of our quote unquote rules for the block center for a structure to stay up was you had to give it a name. And every time they just kept naming it the Burj Khalifa because mine's the tallest. So they, by the end of the year, they could all spell Burj Khalifa without looking at anything. And it was so funny. But to the point, it is following their interest 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing when we, you know, I feel somewhere along the way, we stopped trusting children and their instincts to tell us what they need. And we kind of took it on ourselves. Well, now we kind of have this gap of what we're wanting them to learn versus what they want to learn. And, you know, I think if we start, again, watching them, observing them and trusting them and kind of hopping on board with them and following them, it's going to create so much more knowledge and opportunity and opposed to us trying to just do a checklist of you need to learn this. Well, no, it's got to connect back to them.
Exactly. And it's more likely to stick. I mean, I always laugh because being a tutor, the way our system is, okay, this week's fractions, next week's integers, next week's whatever, and then it's done. And then they don't do it again until the following year. So I've had students for over a decade, and every year I find myself reteaching certain students things because it meant absolutely nothing to them the previous year. So they didn't make the connections, and I would love to see elementary schools approach a whole child alphabet approach, a whole child math approach. Maybe that's your next book.
I've had several people ask me that. So now I'm starting to like think in my head, okay, how do I approach this one? So
yeah. Oh my gosh. Block play. That's all. Write a whole book. On block play. There is so much math there. That is amazing. And I want to kind of switch gears from vision to the physical development, because we're talking about, yes, the goal eventually is for a child to hold a pencil. But I mean, I don't know about you, but I hear pushback all the time. Well, when are they going to write? How often are they going to be holding a pencil? And you're like, hold on a second. It is so much more than just holding a pencil, but there are multiple steps that need to happen before we get there.
Yes. Again, I was always interested in physical development, but I think my passion developed, again, based on my oldest son and my journey I went through with him as a parent. But that's when I really started recognizing just how the whole body works as a team, and just how our big muscles really have to be stabilized to support the mobility of our smaller muscles. And, you know, this really kind of started making connections for me as far as children need to be climbing, you know, up the slide. They need to be like hanging upside down, you know, on the monkey bars, all the things that we don't allow them to do. But that truly develops, again, that neck and the torso and the shoulders. And those have to be stabilized to support the arm and the hand. And then even the hand has to have a certain amount of development before it's capable of holding a pen or pencil. And when my oldest son was doing occupational therapy, yeah, I would ask the OTs all these questions, but I was like, if we were just, you know, kind of back in the day before, you know, we were, you know, always concerned about children writing too early, and we didn't have that pressure, what would be like just kind of a typical time that children's bodies are ready to support the handwriting? And the OTs were like around age 6 or 7, and we're really introducing it so much earlier. And what happens is, and I do this in a lot of my trainings where I have the people in my training, I'm like, put a pencil in your non-dominant hand and try and write. And, you know, and they do odd things with their bodies. And I'm like, what's happening is I've given you a task that you're not capable of, you know, or, you know, that non-dominant arm is not refined enough to do this task. So you're compensating. So I'm like, you're pulling a shoulder, you're doing a death grip on the pen. And I'm like, that's kind of the same thing that we're doing to children when we're introducing that formal handwriting instruction before they're ready. And then I'm like, if I had you the next couple hours were together, only write with your non-dominant hand, how will your body feel? And everybody's like, you know, it's going to be hurting. It's going to be aching because we're using it in an odd way. And I'm like, again, the same thing we're doing with young children by introducing the formal writing instruction too early. And it's really just trying to, you know, open our eyes to kids have got to be moving. They have to be constantly, you know, having the opportunity to climb and run and spin. You know, we have our proprioceptive system and our vestibular system, which are our internal senses. Well, those contribute to reading and writing just as much as the muscle skills do. And so, well, how do those develop? Out on the playground, spinning and swinging and seesaws and all those things, again, that we tend to not see anymore. But it all works as a team and it all has to develop. And we're really doing a disservice to young children if we're at 3 and 4 giving them a worksheet and having them do a you know, trace dot-to-dot letters.
100%. And I totally, while you were talking, switched to my non-dominant hand. And I can tell you already, my shoulder is like, what are you doing? And I can feel it all the way up. Such a great activity to put that perspective. But to your point, absolutely. I think we use outdoor time as a reward too often. Mm-hmm. And it should never be the reward. It's the necessity is getting out and doing that gross motor, but also finding ways to bring gross motor into our programs. And that is always a challenge. Have you ever seen any unique ways that people have been able to do that?
You know, I think it comes back to how we like, I think we kind of have to shift the paradigm of thought on what our classrooms look like and making sure that, you know, that there is maybe a gross motor area or some space where just children can lay down and move around and just have this big body movement, you know, maybe have mats of some sort. They're like a wedge shape where children can roll down them, but like kind of think what we can put in our environment. I think one of the things that we want to kind of be careful of, and I kind of tapped into this a little bit in the book, is I think we get excited. We're like, okay, they need this gross motor movement. And so then we plan just a specific space away from the classroom or a specific time that we have like a special gross motor experience. And there's nothing wrong with that at all, but children need to have access to this all the time. Like, it's not just something we do from 10 to 10:30 or just when we go outside. They need to have this opportunity. So I think it just really requires just kind of thinking outside the box. What are, you know, what are materials we could bring in, like hula hoops or scarves or something that really encourages that whole body movement? But just making sure children have that access to it whenever it is they need it.
Yes. And I think back to my, I had two kindergarten classrooms back to back. One was a massive room where we had so much room to move around. And then one was so tiny, we couldn't have a lot of gross motor. But somebody once suggested, and I didn't stay at the center long enough to implement it, was a chin-up bar on the doorframe. Because you can put it up and take it down. Yeah. So like, just if they needed to get it out, it was something that was out of the way. And also you can get on, I think it's Amazon, little balance beams. So it's just like a little teeter totter for their feet. So there are ways to interject that into even the smallest of classrooms.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's important too, if you're working with like the toddler age, they like to climb, you know, and I'm a firm believer that children's brains tell their bodies what they need, and then their actions tell us. And I've heard so many parents and teachers of toddlers go, they're just climbing the furniture. It's like, because they need to climb. Their body's telling them, we've got to develop this, you know, this torso part of our body. Well, that develops through climbing. So, you know, if you can have some sort of climbing structure within the classroom, if there's an opportunity for them to climb, they're not going to be climbing the furniture. They're still going to be climbing, but in a space that is designed for that.
Oh, yes. And I highly encourage everyone that's listening to check out movement rooms. That I feel like I'm getting targeted on Instagram a little bit, because I start, you know, when you start looking at something on Instagram now, that's all you're getting as suggestions.
Yeah, so exactly.
Maybe it's not as big as I think it is, but movement rooms are indoor gross motor structures, and that you screw to your walls, but they don't take over the whole room. Because they don't need the floor, because they go up against the wall. And it is so cool to see what some people can do. They've got like hanging monkey bars, a rock climbing wall up the side. And honestly, if I was in kindergarten, that would be the big purchase for me, because I had climbers all the way through. No matter what age group I taught, I always had the climbers.
And I think we're probably going to see more and more, like as children getting older, because if they're not getting that satisfaction, they're going to be seeking it, you know, no matter what, you know, what the environment is, like you said. So even like the older children might be seeking those climbing experiences. So I'll have to check that out.
Oh, yeah. They're very, very cool. Awesome. So Stacey, obviously the first step is getting your book, but yes. What would you say is after the book, if you had to give everybody one first step to start implementing the whole child alphabet, what would you say is number one?
Honestly, I think it's getting the conversation going with your coworkers and your administration, because I can just say, based on all the trainings I've done and conversations I've had, I think what keeps people, what the barrier that people see is, okay, my administrators are not going to let me do this, or the parents are going to be thinking this. And I think if we can start getting the conversation going and just, can we think about this? Can we process this? Have we thought of it this way? And I think it kind of starts opening everybody's minds a little bit, where you might not get the pushback. And that might kind of free us up a little bit to start, you know, kind of start implementing more of this, you know, within our environments and within the classroom. And then I would also encourage to step back and watch children play. And start making notes and start seeing what is it that's important to them, what's organically coming up that I might have missed before, and start kind of going from there. But I think those are probably the two big things to maybe kind of start heading this direction. And everything's a baby step. Nothing happens overnight. It's just a matter of start making those small little changes. And then you'll look back and go, oh, wow, like, we're here, and it makes so much more sense now.
Oh my gosh. And it's so true, because you'll look back and be like, oh my gosh, I wish we'd started sooner. And we have to dispel that, because the point is that you started in the first place, but it really is magical when we embrace that play-based learning and just those little changes. I always think James Clear from Atomic Habits saying, you know, be 1% better today than you were yesterday and how it's an exponential growth. And that's what we're doing when we implement things like this in our programs.
Yeah, exactly.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. All the links for your book will be below. I hope that everybody gets a copy because
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and it's a perfect guide without it being restricting. And I think it's just perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.